Fry presents The Dongle of Donald Trefusis, written and read by Stephen Fry. I look about me today at modern streets, busy with modern commerce, where a gay throng of market stalls sells pirated DVDs, counterfeit fashion pieces, and amusing joke T-shirts that celebrate beer and flatulence. The modern world going about its modern business. But many years ago, when all round here was green fields through which shepherds and goatherds drove their sheep and their goats, when the world many years ago was innocent, or at least yet to be proven guilty, I went to university. The seat of learning in question was at Cambridge in the east of England. I shan't weary you with tales of my triumphs, failures, loves and adventures there. That's for another time, in another medium, and will be available at another equally reasonable price. No, I want to tell you about someone I met at Cambridge, who was to be the principal influence on my young life, and in whose shadows I still feel myself blindly to be stumbling, groping, and clumsily crashing forwards. The best, or at least luckiest, of us have nestors, guides, tutors, mentors, men or women in our lives who show us where the light switch is, who teach or attempt to teach our lazy minds how to think. Yes, there are books, there are tapes, there's Wikipedia. In Britain, there's the Open University. There are libraries and resources available to all. But to have a wise friend and an erudite and good-natured teacher, well, this is a privilege accorded only a lucky few. Authority is a word perhaps debased or misunderstood. To know someone to whom you cede authority is a glorious thing, for it is another way of showing trust. I know that some people only have to hear the words Cambridge or Oxford to spew up verbally and actually. You'll have to forgive me and believe that I completely understand how galling, irritating, pretentious, posing, posturing, and imponderably ghastly must seem the self-satisfaction of Oxbridge graduates. But bear in mind, if you would, that Cambridge, as is Oxford, is a university. That's all. No more of one than Leeds, Sussex, Manchester, or UEA. No less of one, either. It has its share of posers, smug self-fantasists, snobs, and creeps, as does any institution. Anyway, enough defensive manoeuvring, young Stephen. On we go. St. Matthew's College is not Cambridge's most fashionable college, being tucked away as it is between the Backs and Trinity Street. Indeed, many who have nothing to do with Cambridge have not heard of it in the way they will know, without knowing, of more celebrated bodies such as King's College, St. John's, Trinity, and Christ's. St. Matthew's was founded in 1588, a reasonably late addition to the roster of colleges. That was the year Queen Elizabeth's navy saw off the Spanish Armada, of course, and it was perhaps in a resultant spirit of optimism, patriotic fervour, and blind hope that the college was founded by Sir Philip Peveril, Francis Drake's right-hand man, a privateer, swashbuckler, and sea dog of the old school. Drake's right-hook man, I should say, for Sir Philip had lost his right hand in a quarter-deck fight with the boatswain of the Golden Hind. Perhaps it was guilt at his illicitly heaped-up treasures and roistering life on the main that inspired Peveril to found a sober seat of learning so far from the sea. Perhaps, too, scoundrel that he was, it was his idea of a joke to name the foundation after that one of Jesus' disciples who started life as a tax collector. No matter, St. Matthew's quietly flourishes to this day, a 420-year-old collegiate part of an 800-year-old whole. It was almost exactly 30 years ago, in 1979, towards the end of my first year as an undergraduate at St. Matthew's, that I first encountered the college's senior tutor, who was also the university's Regius Professor of Philology, Dr. Donald Trefusis. I had heard of him, of course. Who hadn't? This was a man who spoke 17 languages fluently and could read, write, and converse in another 20. By the time he had arrived at 30, snowy white hair had already overtaken the last of his chestnut locks, lending him an early look of ancient wisdom that he did much, in public at least, to undermine. There were rumours that he had had something to do with spying, whether for Her Majesty's government or for Red Russia, no one was quite sure. We thought it impolite to ask. Certainly his linguistic attainments often took him around the world on lecture tours, plenary gatherings, and academic conferences. But this is not a memoir, this is an introduction to my main business with you. So, Over my university years, Trefusis, who saw something in me which was not wholly flattering and which I think amused him, befriended me. "You have a good brain, Mr. Fry," he was fond of saying, "but a dreadful mind. Quite the wrong way round." Well, after university I drifted into a low set of media scum, spinning lower and lower into the depths, until I found myself a year or so after graduation, all shame gone, working in what can only be called show business, and amongst other things, on radio programmes for the BBC. Unsure how to provide enough of what would now be called content, I would weekly visit my old friend and tutor, Professor Trefusis, in his Cambridge fastness, and, frankly, get him to do the work for me, composing and reading into my microphone what he called his wireless essays, which I would bring back to London and broadcast on Saturday mornings for a programme called Loose Ends, presented by the late and much-missed Ned Sherrin. But this is all local fiff and faff. Those of you listening in America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, and Burkina Faso will have no interest in these parochial details. I'm hurrying to the chase, I do assure you. Later on, I turned one of the European adventures I shared with the professor into a novel, which was published in 1991 as my first book, The Liar, in which Trefusis played a major part. Amazon will be happy to deliver this magnificent read right to your door. I cannot imagine that you will ever read a more diverting and charming novel in all your life. ISBN 0-7493-0541-1. Anyway, I rather moved away from Trefusis after The Liar's publication, such is the callousness of youth and the indolence of middle age. By the mid-90s, we were all but strangers, communicating only occasionally by tart postcard on his part and hastily patted out email on mine. And then, late last year, while I was filming in Madagascar, news reached me that at the age of 87, Donald Cornwallis Treadway Trefusis, Professor Emeritus, Quondam Fellow of St. Matthew's College, guide, teacher and friend, departed this life. He died. Like everyone else, I read the obituaries and marvelled at the scope and range of the man. Here was the life of what we Jews call a mensch, a someone, a real someone. I was surprised at how grief-stricken I was. But as so often with the death of friends, the grief was selfish. I had not said goodbye. I had failed to know him better. I had let him down. I had shamed and disappointed him. I had been cruelly casual in our friendship. And he had let me down, too. I could not but feel that it was rude and unfair of him to leave the party so precipitately and without bidding me farewell. How dare he age and die like that? How dare he? For a week I remained in the grip of this petulant and unreasonable mood, and then, like a bolt from the cliché, came the letter from Hodgman, 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 Hodgman and Hodgman. I have it still. "Dear Mr. Fry," it read, "as solicitors acting in the matter of the will of the recently deceased Donald Cornwallis Treadway Trefusis, we ask that you might be kind enough to visit our offices in St. Edward's Passage, Cambridge, at your earliest convenience, yours, etc." An astonishing communication. What could it portend? I called the offices of Hodgman, 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 Hodgman and Hodgman and arranged to see them at the earliest opportunity. At the time, I was sunk deep in recordings of a BBC quiz-style, panel-style, game-style programme called QI, and it wasn't until a week following the letter from Hodgman, 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 Hodgman and Hodgman that I managed to catch a train to Cambridge, cab myself to the Garden House Hotel, leg it to King's Parade, and enter St. Edward's Passage in search of the offices of Hodgman, 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 Hodgman and Hodgman, which I found next door to the Haunted Bookshop, one of Cambridge's finest purveyors of rare, collectible and inspiring second-hand books. The dimple-paned window of Hodgman, 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 Hodgman and Hodgman had painted on it in fine gold lettering, "Hodgman, Hodgman, Hodgman, Hodgman and Hodgman, Solicitors at Law, Notaries, Commissioners for Oaths." I pushed open the door and entered. "Hello, I wonder if I can speak to Mr. Hodgman," I asked the young man at the front desk. "Oh dear," he said, "I'm afraid he's dead." "Oh, I'm sorry," I said. "As are we all," said the young man. "But we are over the worst of it. He died in 1983, after all." "Oh, well, how about Mr. Hodgman? He's playing golf with a client this afternoon." "Oh, Mr. Hodgman?" "At lunch." "And Mr. Hodgman?" "In a meeting, left strict instructions not to be disturbed." "Well then, what about Mr. Hodgman?" "How can I help you?" said the young man, rising to his feet, extending his hand. "Well, Mr. Hodgman," I said, shaking it, My name is Fry. Ah, yes, Mr. Fry, of course. Do come through. So, I said, as I sat down in Mr. Hodgman's pleasantly old-fashioned office, quite the family firm. No, said Mr. Hodgman, we five Hodgmans are not related at all, just one of those inexplicable coincidences. Goodness. Quite. Would you like a cappuccino at all? No? Well, let's get right down to it. Were you, I wonder, aware of Dr. Trefusis's testamentary dispositions? What was in his will, you mean? No, the professor and I had drifted apart over the years. I know there was family in the West Country somewhere who have received the bulk of his estate, money, chattels, and so forth. I am empowered, however, to read this codicil to his last will. Mr. Hodgman took an envelope from a box file in front of him, drew from it a sheet of paper, and began to read. I said. Perhaps if you read it out loud? Oh, I'm so sorry. Force of habit. My children are telepathic. Forgive me. Mr. Hodgman cleared his throat and began to recite in a clear voice. Having disposed of such unimportant matters as money... Unimportant, said Mr. Hodgman in an incredulous aside. His estate has been valued at £9 million. Good Lord, I said. I had no idea. I know. Still, where were we? Mr. Hodgman took up the letter again. Having disposed of such unimportant matters as money, I turn now to what I believe is termed my intellectual property. There are few people in the world who would be interested in my researches into the philology of the Turkish language, and I can think of only seven, of whom two are already dead, who might be stirred by my sensational discoveries concerning the development of the periphrastic do and the relationship between Inuit and Uzbek prepositions of distance. Be that as it may, this strictly academic work I bequeath to St. Matthew's College in the full and certain knowledge that it will bore and irritate them. The labours of my lifetime have yielded other fruits, however, and these fruits I would be happy to see given over absolutely to an old pupil of mine, Stephen Fry, care of the BBC London. This gentleman is in many respects a grave disappointment to me. Intellectually and morally lazy, he has ignored any small potential he may have had for fulfilling work or permanent achievement, and worshipped instead at the neon altar of cheap fame, worldly profit, and false recognition. Never mind, it so happens that as a result of the course through life he has chosen, he, amongst all my old pupils, is now in an unique position to disseminate, inasmuch as they are worth the disseminating, the store of... I stopped listening to young Mr. Hodgman's voice at this point. The old devil. False recognition. Cheap fame. Morally and intellectually lazy, indeed. And now, to overcome these perceived shortcomings in me, he had left me a pile of his damned papers, had he? Well, damn an arses to him. I suppose he thought it would be good for my soul to sift through sheaves of his blasted scribblings and try and find publishers for them. The voice of young Mr. Hodgman droned on. In recompense for this slight service, my entire collection of books will be his to do with as he pleases, a not inconsiderable library that he may sell or keep. It makes no difference to me, for I am dead. I jerked back into attention. You could have knocked me down with a cliché. His books! I hope, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm not a greedy man, but I knew Trefusis's library to be one of the treasures of the town, the complete first editions of all the modern novelists, from Henry James to Ian Fleming, whom he reverenced, and Graham Greene, whom he did not, manuscripts that included scribbled sermons from George Herbert and John Donne, signed copies of Dickens, Flaubert, Baudelaire, and Rilke. I licked my lips. The splendour, the cachet, the kudos, the value. A sinking heart knew, somewhere inside itself, that I would, in all decency, be forced to give the library away to some school or charity, but to own it even for a month or so. Mr. Hodgson was pushing the document back into its envelope. He smiled across at me. An unusual bequest. It appoints you executor to one part of his property while making you beneficiary of another. There's no conflict or impropriety there. Here is a copy of the codicil and a key which he commanded me to pass to you. If you'd be good enough to sign here, thank you. And perhaps you could think a signature for my children here. Good day, Mr. Fry. I stammered out my thanks and bade the man goodbye, stumbling into a handful of returning Hodgmans as I left. I spent the next 2 hours wandering about Cambridge, attempting, without much success, to straighten things out in my mind. I came at last on my third circuit of the centre of town to a cocktail tea shop, where I sat myself down and ordered a stiff Darjeeling on the rocks straight up with a twist. The codicil, which I slipped out of its envelope and examined more closely, was written in Trefusis's unmistakable flowing hand, black ink and a broad italic nib. Like Humphrey Lyttelton, another recently deceased octogenarian whom I admired very much, Trefusis had a high doctrine of handwriting. They were both calligraphists of no mean order, and that gift, that achieved skill, slight in itself, some might think, set me thinking on death and loss. Over the years, these great, estimable, and irreplaceable men had trained their hands and eyes to fashion lettering of the highest quality, smooth, even, flowing, and exquisitely proportioned. Classical calligraphy, yet endowed with their personal flourishes, curlicues, and embellishments, such that their hands were instantly recognizable. And this gift, this accomplishment, where had it gone? The hands were burned to ashes with the rest of the fleshly remains, so that even if one believed in an afterlife, one could hardly claim that the same hands and eyes were magically reassembled in paradise. So the gift, so long achieved, so hard won, had gone up in smoke. I console myself with this possibility. All great men and women are teachers. If only it worked both ways, and one could syllogize that all teachers were great men and women, but alas, no. So I thought to myself, the gift of calligraphy shared by Trefusis and Lyttelton may not have disappeared. It will live on in those they taught and influenced. And their greater gifts, Trefusis's languages and learning, Lyttelton's musical brilliance and jazz scholarship, and their greater gifts still, their wit, their kindness, their charm, where had they gone? Well, they had lived on too. Lyttelton's in the influence he spread wherever he went. Trefusis's in, well, in me, it would seem, in my ability to pass on the wisdom and learning he had left in the form of these papers that he wanted me to, what was the word he had used? That he wanted me to disseminate. To disseminate, he would remind me, was what sowers did to seeds. Semen seminar, the Latin for seed, seminary, seminal. Another word for to sow seeds was to broadcast, to scatter them wide about, to sow them abroad, to cast them broadly. And I dare say I was chosen as executor of Trefusis's estate because he thought I could broadcast them in the modern sense, and thus, in some small way, I could keep the man alive. Well, I was not the first to sit and cogitate on the mystery of death. I may have been the first to sit and cogitate on the mystery of death while sipping an Earl Grey Cosmopolitan. I give that cocktail tea shop 2 months, a noble experiment, but I fear doomed. I came to no great conclusions about death. It remains and should remain a mystery. As the ancient Greeks understood, anyone who claims to know what happens to us after death is either a fool or a liar. We can all hope and wish and repose faith in the claims of others, but none of us can know. One thing I knew, however, was that a part of Trefusis's gifts, qualities, wisdom and character reposed somewhere in his old rooms in St. Matthew's, and that he had entrusted me with the task of passing them on. I had not the skill nor wit to pass on in my own writings 1/10 of his qualities, but as a medium for their transmission, well, he was right. I was uniquely placed. I had access. So I mused as I drained another English breakfast and tonic and tottered into the street. Irksome and tedious as it may have seemed, my duty lay clear ahead of me. Trefusis wanted me to publish his essays, so publish them I would. Hair streaming behind me, tear-stained and tea-stained, I staggered down past Caius College and towards the well-remembered gates of St. Matthew's. It was full term still, so everywhere about me bicycles wheeled and squealed. A university, wherever it is in the world, is not a place, but a time. This Cambridge was no more my university than Cardiff, Kiel, or Canterbury, for this Cambridge was alive in 2009, and mine only existed in the past, in the years 1978, 79, 80, and 81. My Cambridge had died, leaving only a barely recognizable skeleton of medieval bones. Funny things, students. Girls and boys of such seriousness, even their levity has gravity. But they are young at the wrong time, I suppose. Now, today, perhaps for the first time in eons, we have a body of youth that is less well off than their parents were at their age. For decade after decade, each succeeding generation was better blessed with the world's goods than the preceding, but not any longer. I once attended a meeting, I think of the Shirley Society at St. Catherine's College, where Anthony Powell, the novelist, gave a talk. Someone asked him, perhaps it was me, whether or not there was a difference in our generation of students compared to his 1930s generation. "Well, there is something missing with you undergraduates today," the old man said. "I would call it lightness of touch." And if we were grave, how much graver are students a quarter of a century further on, their sights set on jobs, careers, loan repayments, the impossibility of joining a fractured world in which the possession of a house seems an improbable dream, future decades of only being able to live at home with their parents, free laundry, but free humiliation and frustration too. I shook myself out of this reverie, sending leaves of orange pekoe and Formosan oolong into the eddies which whipped in from the college gates. The head porter, Stillman, must have recognised me, for he had the same greeting as of old. "And who might you be, sir?" When all was cleared up, "Well, I was like to know you'd put on 5 stone and get them bags under your eyes." Mr. Stillman insisted on escorting me to B staircase, Old Court, where Trefusis had rooms until his death, a signal honour in these cold times that is rarely accorded a college fellow who might legitimately be regarded as past his teaching or contributing age. "I'll leave you alone now, Mr. Lorry," said Stillman, who really is getting quite senile now, I fear. There was no scent of senescence in the set of rooms, no hint of that distressing mixture of odours that so boldly spells out the indignities of old age, a hint of lavender from the furniture wax and teak oil that Mrs. Shatterwell and Mrs. Underbridge, Trefusis's bedder and cleaner, so assiduously applied to the room's furniture, the familiar must and dust of books, a rich undertow of Madeira and sherry wines, traces, too, of an aroma of pipe tobacco that testified to a habit long since regretfully and reluctantly abandoned, and which had somehow penetrated the fabrics and fittings of the rooms beyond the powers of either Mrs. Shatterwell or Mrs. Underbridge to banish. That was all. A last shaft of the dying sun bounced from the bust of Goethe onto the pen-and-wash portrait of Joyce, past the gouache of Bologna University and the photograph of the John Player-winning Somerset cricket side, and shiningly reposed at last on the shelves above the fireplace. One hot spot of light caught my eye from where I stood in the centre of the room and flared from the edge of the cellophaned jacket of a book that I approached and picked from the shelf. It was a signed edition of You Only Live Twice. I read the epigraph, "You only live twice, once when you are born and once when you stare death in the face." Was that a genuine Basho haiku or one made up by Fleming? I couldn't recall, and Trefusis wasn't there to set me right. Well, you lived your 2 lives, Donald, and now here I am to see if you can live a 3rd time in the minds of those who never knew you. The small hairs at the back of my neck prickled, and I had that unmistakable feeling that someone had walked over my cliché. Shaking this aside, I took the key that young Mr. Hodgman had given me and held it out in front of me, lining it up with such doors and drawers as the room afforded. A wooden filing cabinet proved to be unlocked and yielded nothing of interest. The central drawer of Trefusis's bureau, however, that was locked. The key fitted, but needed the kind of violent torsion that made me fearful that it might snap inside the lock, which only slowly began to give. Suddenly, a voice awoke in my head. "There's a trick to it, Stephen. Lift as you turn." Good Lord! I had opened this drawer before, but I could not even remember why or how. Oh, yes! The years rolled back and the scene returned to me now. Trefusis lying on the ottoman with a silk handkerchief on his face. Me reading him a chapter of my dissertation on the great fricative shift. He asks me to fetch some aspirin from the locked drawer, a key to which he languidly passes to me, and which I am now turning in that very same lock, 25 years and a lifetime later. I sat now at the desk and tugged so impatiently at the drawer that it yielded with a great jerk and flew out and punched me in my belly, the brass centre handle stabbing my gut. But the hardest punch to the belly was the circumstance that the drawer was empty. No papers, no notes, nothing. Wait. That wasn't quite true. What was that hiding in the corner, small, flat and incongruous? It wasn't. Couldn't be. Not from Donald Trefusis, but it was a flash drive, an 8 GB USB drive by all that was holy. I blew dust from its connector and looked about the study. I could see no computer in the room. I knew Trefusis used one, for he was capable always of receiving my emails when I could bestir myself enough to send them, and to which he would always reply by handwritten card, but there was not a sign of anything electronic or digital in the room. If he had a computer, I supposed it had been taken by his family, to whom he had left everything that was not a book or a paper. Everything but this dongle, as some called them. If there had been a record for the half-mile dash between Old Court St. Matthews and Room 120 at the Garden House Hotel, it was shattered that afternoon. My unibody 15-inch MacBook Pro lay open on the desk, simply gagging for a good dongling. I slipped the thing in and waited breathless while it mounted. There was the image. My heart banged in my throat as soon as my eyes had conveyed to my brain that the disc was entitled For Stephen. I double-clicked. Files. Hundreds of files, all of them with the extension .mp3. 1.listen_2_me_first.mp3 headed the list. Another double-click and...
Hello, Stephen. It's been quite a time, hasn't it? Your old friend, if I might be permitted the term... Donald Trefusis here, speaking to you, oh, how I have longed to be able to say this, from beyond the grave, which is to say, I am dead, quite dead. Now listen to me, listen to me. There is something you have to do.
The contents of the doctor's dongle will be revealed. You've been listening to Stephen Fry's The Dongle of Donald Trefusis.